Miguel de Cervantes' masterpiece Don Quixote has captivated readers for over four centuries, earning its place as the first modern novel and one of the most influential works in literary history. Published in two parts, 1605 and 1615, this revolutionary tale continues to resonate with readers worldwide, inspiring countless adaptations across film, theater, ballet, and music. Even today, celebrities like Johnny Depp and Oprah Winfrey cite it among their favorite books, while phrases like tilting at windmills have entered everyday language. The novel's cultural impact is so profound that the Spanish language itself is sometimes called the language of Cervantes. What makes this comic yet profound meditation on idealism and reality so enduringly powerful? Let's embark on our own quest through the windmill-dotted landscapes of La Mancha to discover why this tale of a self-made knight continues to enchant us. In an unnamed village in La Mancha lives a country gentleman whose obsession with books of chivalry has driven him to madness. After sleepless nights spent devouring tales of knights, giants, and damsels in distress, his mind dries up completely. This gentleman, around 50 years old, lean-bodied with a gaunt face, decides to become what he has read about, a knight-errant who will win eternal fame through valorous deeds. He refurbishes his great-grandfather's rusty armor, fashions a helmet from pasteboard and iron strips, and renames his decrepit nag Rocinante, signifying its elevation from common horse to knight's steed. After 8 days of contemplation, he dubs himself Don Quixote of La Mancha to honor his homeland. Finally, he selects a peasant girl named Aldonza Lorenzo as the object of his courtly love, renaming her Dulcinea of Toboso, though she remains entirely unaware of this distinction. Thus equipped and inspired, Don Quixote sets out on his first adventure. At an inn he mistakes for a castle, he demands the innkeeper, whom he sees as the castle's steward, to dub him a knight. The innkeeper, an Andalusian from Sanlúcar with a thief's reputation, plays along with Don Quixote's delusions, performing a mock ceremony that includes blows to the neck and shoulders. Two serving girls assist, and Don Quixote finds himself a knight in less than an hour. This transformation illustrates the novel's central theme, the power of imagination to reshape reality. Don Quixote doesn't merely read about knights, he becomes one through sheer force of will. His madness stems not from hallucinations, but from interpretation. He sees what others see, but assigns different meaning to it. When we reinvent ourselves, aren't we all, in some sense, engaging in this same process? We craft narratives about who we are and what our purpose might be. Don Quixote simply takes this universal human tendency to its logical extreme. What's particularly fascinating is how Don Quixote's madness is selective. He can speak with remarkable eloquence and wisdom on subjects unrelated to chivalry, leading many characters to observe that he seems to possess lucid intervals. This pattern of specific delusion surrounded by general sanity raises questions about the nature of madness itself. Perhaps we all maintain areas of irrationality while functioning reasonably in other aspects of life. No knight is complete without a squire, and Don Quixote finds his in Sancho Panza, a poor farmer and neighbor whom he persuades to join him with promises of governing an insula, island, that Don Quixote might win through adventure. Despite initial reluctance, Sancho agrees, bringing saddlebags and insisting on riding his donkey rather than a horse. Sancho represents the perfect foil to Don Quixote, practical where his master is idealistic, concerned with bodily comforts while Don Quixote pursues glory, and speaking in earthy proverbs while the knight delivers flowery speeches. Yet their relationship grows into something far more complex than simple opposition. As they journey together, each begins to absorb aspects of the other's worldview. Their conversations reveal this gradual transformation. When Don Quixote speaks of future rewards, Sancho initially responds with mercenary directness. "If I've had a good lashing, at least I left riding a horse." Yet later, he defends his master's visions to skeptics, and even fabricates elaborate stories about delivering messages to Dulcinea. Meanwhile, Don Quixote occasionally shows flashes of Sancho's practicality, especially after suffering physical consequences of his delusions. The promise of reward drives much of Sancho's loyalty, particularly the governorship of an insula. This promise becomes reality when the Duke and Duchess, having read the published first part of Don Quixote's adventures, decide to amuse themselves by making Sancho governor of a small town. Sancho's brief tenure reveals unexpected wisdom. He dispenses clever justice in several cases, including uncovering a hidden loan repayment in a walking stick and exposing a woman falsely claiming assault. Yet he ultimately abandons the position, declaring, "I wasn't born to be a governor. I know more about plowing and digging and pruning vines than I do about making laws or defending provinces or kingdoms." This episode illustrates another of the novel's key insights. Positions of power often prove less satisfying than imagined. Sancho discovers that governance brings responsibility, anxiety, and restrictions on his freedom and appetite. His decision to return to Don Quixote represents a choice of friendship and adventure over status and security, a surprisingly modern rejection of conventional success in favor of personal fulfillment. Don Quixote's most famous adventure occurs early in his journeys when he spots 30 or 40 windmills across the plains of Montiel and declares them to be fearsome giants with arms nearly 2 leagues long. Despite Sancho's increasingly desperate protests that they are merely windmills used for grinding grain, Don Quixote charges forward on Rocinante, lance extended, shouting, "Flee not, cowards and vile beings, for it is a single knight who attacks you." The windmill's massive sail catches his lance, lifting both knight and horse into the air before dropping them painfully to the ground. Even then, Don Quixote refuses to acknowledge reality, blaming his defeat on his nemesis, the wizard Freston, who he claims transformed the giants into windmills just as victory was within his grasp. This pattern of misperception repeats throughout the novel, creating a rich tapestry of comic misadventures. Don Quixote perceives ordinary objects as extraordinary challenges, charging headlong into confrontation, suffering physical consequences, and then rationalizing his failure through elaborate explanations involving enchanters and magic. He mistakes humble inns for magnificent castles, complete with towers and silver pinnacles. Common prostitutes become high-born ladies worthy of his courtly devotion. Flocks of sheep transform into opposing armies, leading to disaster when he charges into their midst. Even puppet shows become real events requiring his heroic intervention, as when he destroys Master Pedro's puppet theater to save a fictional damsel in distress. One particularly amusing episode occurs at Juan Palomeque's inn when Don Quixote, sleepwalking and dreaming of battling the giant panda Philando, violently slashes several large wineskins hanging in his room. Standing in his nightshirt, he thrusts and parries against imaginary foes, flooding the floor with red wine he believes to be the giant's blood. The innkeeper, furious at the destruction of his best wine, demands payment for the damaged wineskins. Sancho, caught between loyalty to his master and recognition of reality, attempts to mediate by insisting that the giant's head has mysteriously disappeared due to enchantment, while privately lamenting that his share of the non-existent spoils has vanished as well. These misadventures serve multiple purposes within the narrative structure. They provide comic relief through physical humor and the stark contrast between Don Quixote's grandiose expectations and mundane reality. They illustrate the knight's unwavering commitment to his chivalric worldview, even in the face of overwhelming evidence to the contrary. More profoundly, they raise fundamental questions about the nature of perception and reality. If we all filter experience through our preconceptions and beliefs, how can we be certain of what's real? Don Quixote's absolute conviction in his version of reality forces readers to examine their own certainties. modern cognitive science and psychology have confirmed what Cervantes intuited, that perception is not passive reception, but active construction. Our brains actively create our experience of reality, filling in gaps with assumptions based on past experience and expectations. Studies of confirmation bias and selective attention demonstrate how we tend to see what we expect to see, filtering out contradictory information. Don Quixote's windmill episode has become such an enduring metaphor precisely because it dramatically illustrates this universal human tendency to project meaning onto the world. The difference is merely one of degree. Don Quixote's projections are simply more dramatic and consequential than our everyday misperceptions, but they spring from the same psychological mechanisms that shape all human experience. At the heart of Don Quixote's quest lies his devotion to Dulcinea of Toboso, the lady to whom he has dedicated his knightly service. Yet Dulcinea exists only in Don Quixote's imagination, a transformation of Aldonza Lorenzo, a sturdy peasant girl who could throw a metal bar as well as the brawniest lad, and who remains completely unaware of her elevation to the status of peerless beauty. When Sancho expresses shock at learning Dulcinea's true identity, Don Quixote explains that poets often idealize ordinary women, and in his imagination, Aldonza is transformed into the peerless Dulcinea. "I imagine that everything I say about her is true," he declares, "not because it is, but because I want it to be." This idealization of love objects speaks to something fundamental in human experience. Don't we all, to some extent, fall in love not with actual people, but with our idealized versions of them? The gap between Aldonza's reality and Dulcinea's perfection mirrors the distance between how we perceive our loved ones and who they truly are. The Dulcinea storyline takes a comic turn when Don Quixote sends Sancho to deliver a message to her. Unable to find the non-existent Dulcinea, Sancho identifies a peasant girl on the road and tells Don Quixote this is his lady. When Don Quixote sees only a coarse country girl, Sancho claims she has been transformed by evil enchanters, using Don Quixote's own logic against him. This enchantment becomes a central preoccupation for Don Quixote, who believes he must somehow break the spell. Later, the Duke and Duchess, who have read the published account of Don Quixote's adventures, elaborate on this deception. They arrange for the supposed enchanter Merlin to appear and announce that Dulcinea can only be disenchanted if Sancho gives himself 3,300 lashes on his buttocks. Sancho's reluctance to administer this punishment to himself becomes a running joke throughout the remainder of the novel. The Dulcinea subplot brilliantly illustrates how our ideals can become more important to us than reality. Don Quixote's devotion to a woman who doesn't exist as he imagines her represents the triumph of imagination over experience, the human capacity to create meaning and beauty even when confronted with contrary evidence. In the second part of the novel, Don Quixote and Sancho encounter a duke and duchess who have read the published account of their earlier adventures. Delighted to meet these famous figures, the noble couple invites them to their castle and designs elaborate pranks to entertain themselves at the knight and squire's expense. These episodes represent a fascinating meta-fictional turn in the narrative. The characters have become aware of themselves as literary figures and must contend with their own fame. The Duke and Duchess, as readers of the first part, represent us, the audience, brought into the story itself. Their delight in orchestrating scenarios that play into Don Quixote's delusions mirrors our own pleasure in reading about his misadventures. The pranks range from comical to cruel. They convince Don Quixote that Dulcinea can only be disenchanted through Sancho's self-flagellation. They create an elaborate fantasy involving a distressed countess with a beard who needs Don Quixote's help. They even make Sancho governor of a small town, subjecting him to increasingly absurd challenges. One particularly cruel joke involves tying Don Quixote's hands to his bedroom window while he sleeps, then having a maid pretend to be in love with him. When she sings a passionate ballad, Don Quixote attempts to invite her into his room but cannot move from the window. Later, servants release cats with bells tied to their tails into his darkened room. One cat leaps at Don Quixote's face, clawing and biting his nose, leaving him badly scratched. These episodes reveal something disturbing about human nature, our capacity to derive entertainment from others' suffering. The Duke and Duchess represent privileged individuals who use their power to manipulate those they consider inferior for their own amusement. Their behavior raises uncomfortable questions about the ethics of entertainment itself. As readers, are we complicit in Don Quixote's humiliation? Do we, like the Duke and Duchess, derive pleasure from his delusions and misfortunes? Yet even amid these manipulations, Don Quixote maintains a certain dignity. His courtesy, eloquence, and unwavering commitment to his ideals often make his tormentors seem small by comparison. When the ecclesiastic at the Duke's castle berates Don Quixote for his delusions, the knight responds with such eloquence about the value of knight-errantry that we cannot help but admire him, even as we recognize his madness. One of the novel's most enigmatic episodes occurs when Don Quixote is lowered into the cave of Montesinos and emerges half an hour later, claiming to have spent 3 days in an underground realm where he encountered figures from chivalric romances. He describes a crystal palace containing the enchanted knight Durandarque, who lies on a marble sepulcher with his heart removed. Don Quixote witnesses a procession of mourning maidens led by the haggard Belerma carrying Durandarte's mummified heart. Most astonishingly, Don Quixote claims to have seen Dulcinea herself, enchanted as a peasant girl, confirming Sancho's earlier deception. He even receives a message from her companion requesting 6 reales and offering an underskirt as security. When questioned about this adventure later, Don Quixote admits uncertainty about whether his experience was real or dreamed. This episode marks a crucial turning point in the novel. Previously, Don Quixote transformed external reality to match his chivalric worldview, seeing windmills as giants and inns as castles. But in the cave of Montesinos, he creates an entirely internal reality, disconnected from external stimuli. The experience troubles him precisely because he cannot determine its status. Was it real or imagined? The Cave of Montesinos sequence raises profound questions about the nature of reality and perception. If our experience of the world is constructed by our minds, how can we distinguish between reality and dream? Don Quixote's uncertainty mirrors philosophical debates dating back to Plato's allegory of the cave and continuing through Descartes' methodical doubt and modern neuroscience's investigations of consciousness. Even the novel's narrator, Cide Hamet Benengeli, expresses doubt about this episode, noting in the margin that he cannot believe the cave adventure, yet hesitates to call Don Quixote a liar. This narrative uncertainty further destabilizes our sense of what constitutes truth within the story world. The cave episode also introduces a new psychological complexity to Don Quixote's character. His doubt about his own experience suggests growing self-awareness about his condition, a crack in the edifice of his delusions that will eventually lead to his return to sanity. Cervantes employs a complex narrative framework that constantly reminds readers they are reading a constructed text rather than experiencing reality directly. He presents himself not as the author, but as the compiler of materials from various sources, primarily the work of an Arab historian named Cide Hamet Benengeli, whose manuscript was supposedly discovered in Toledo's market and translated by a Morisco interpreter. This fictional attribution serves multiple purposes. It creates ironic distance between Cervantes and his creation, allowing him to comment on the narrative from outside. It parodies the common practice in chivalric romances of claiming ancient, authoritative sources, and it raises questions about reliability. Can we trust a history written by a Muslim about a Christian knight, translated by an unnamed Morisco, and compiled by Cervantes? The metafictional aspects become even more complex in the second part, published 10 years after the first. In the interim, another author using the pseudonym Avellaneda had published an unauthorized continuation of Don Quixote's adventures. Cervantes incorporates this real-world literary theft into his narrative. Having characters in the second part discuss the spurious sequel, and Don Quixote himself encounter people who have read it. When Don Quixote learns that this false history depicts him participating in jousts at Saragossa, he immediately changes his plans, declaring he will go to Barcelona instead to prove the modern historian a liar. Later, he encounters a character from Avellaneda's version and obtains a legal declaration that he is not the Don Quixote who appears in that false second part. These metafictional elements highlight the novel's preoccupation with the relationship between literature and reality. Don Quixote's madness stems from confusing books with life, yet the second part shows his own life becoming a book that others read and respond to. The boundaries between text and world, fiction and history, constantly blur and shift. This self-conscious literariness makes Don Quixote remarkably modern. 4 centuries before postmodern novels explored the constructedness of narrative, Cervantes was already playing with multiple levels of fiction, unreliable narrators, and the relationship between authorship and authority. Don Quixote's adventures conclude when he is defeated by the Knight of the White Moon, actually Bachelor Sansón Carrasco in disguise, attempting to cure Don Quixote by forcing him to return home. The terms of defeat require Don Quixote to abstain from knight errantry for a year. Though defeated, Don Quixote refuses to deny Dulcinea's beauty, declaring, "Dulcinea of Toboso is the most beautiful woman in the world, and I am the most unfortunate knight on earth." This defeat marks the beginning of Don Quixote's return to sanity. On the journey home, he proposes becoming a shepherd instead, a pastoral fantasy to replace his chivalric one. But soon after reaching his village, he falls ill with a fever that confines him to bed for 6 days. As his condition worsens, Don Quixote experiences a profound transformation. After sleeping for over 6 hours, he awakens with remarkable clarity, declaring, "Blessed be Almighty God who has done such great good for me." He announces his judgment is restored, recognizing the absurdities of chivalric books that had clouded his mind. Renouncing his identity as Don Quixote, he declares himself once again Alonso Quijano the Good. He makes his confession and dictates his will, providing for his housekeeper and stipulating that his niece will lose her inheritance if she marries a man who reads books of chivalry. Despite Sancho's tearful pleas not to let himself die, Alonso Quijano passes away peacefully, having received all sacraments and renounced chivalric literature. Sansón Carrasco composes an epitaph noting that his great good fortune was to live a madman and die sane. This ending presents a profound paradox. Don Quixote's return to sanity coincides with his physical decline and death, suggesting that his madness was a form of vitality. His delusions, though often leading to physical harm, represented a refusal to accept the limitations of ordinary existence. By creating an alternative identity as a knight-errant, he transformed a mundane life into an epic quest. The novel's conclusion raises uncomfortable questions about the value of illusion versus reality. Is Don Quixote better off sane but dying, or mad but vibrantly engaged with life? Is Alonso Quijano's conventional wisdom superior to Don Quixote's inspired folly? Cervantes offers no simple answers, leaving readers to ponder whether the world needs more sanity or more beautiful madness. 4 centuries after its publication, Don Quixote remains astonishingly relevant to contemporary concerns. Its exploration of identity construction speaks directly to our social media age, where we carefully curate personas for public consumption. Don Quixote's self-transformation from Alonso Quijano to knight-errant anticipates our modern understanding that identities are performed rather than innate. The novel's treatment of reality and perception resonates with current philosophical and scientific debates about consciousness. Neuroscience confirms that our brains actively construct our experience rather than passively receiving information. We all, like Don Quixote, see the world through filters of expectation and desire. Its metafictional elements prefigure postmodern literary techniques by centuries. The complex narrative framework, the characters' awareness of themselves as literary figures, and the incorporation of real-world literary theft into the fictional narrative all feel remarkably contemporary. Perhaps most importantly, Don Quixote presents an enduring meditation on idealism versus practicality. The knight's impossible dreams and Sancho's earthbound concerns represent competing aspects of human nature, our capacity for aspiration and our need for sustenance, our pursuit of meaning and our desire for comfort. What makes the novel truly great is that it refuses to resolve this tension. Don Quixote's madness is simultaneously ridiculous and noble, his delusions both comical and inspiring. Cervantes presents both the value of dreams that exceed reality's limitations and the necessity of acknowledging reality's constraints. In our disenchanted age, Don Quixote reminds us of the power of imagination to transform experience. When the knight declares that a roadside inn is a castle, he's wrong in fact, but right in a deeper sense. He sees the potential for magic in the ordinary, the capacity for transcendence in the mundane. Perhaps we need a touch of quixotic madness to see beyond what is to what could be. The novel's final wisdom may be that sanity and madness, reality and illusion, practicality and idealism are not opposites but complementary aspects of complete human experience. We need both Don Quixote's capacity for vision and Sancho's grounding in reality. The greatest folly may be to embrace either extreme at the expense of the other.